This is a Tuesday, and at least in some parts of our listening area, still a rainy Tuesday edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Late last week, Walmart rolled out its next sustainable initiative, this time in support of local and small agriculture. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has this report.
Walmart, the world's largest retailer based in Bentonville, has set some lofty ecological goals, including someday operating on 100% renewable energy, creating zero waste, and selling products that sustain people and the environment, all part of its new identity as Next Generation Walmart. As part of that agenda, the company rolled out a global agriculture commitment October 14th. In a news release, Mike Duke said that given current population projections, food supplies will have to increase by 70% to feed an estimated 9 billion people in 2050. And Walmart will help meet that need, he said, but in a sustainable way. On a company webcast taped in a Walmart produce aisle, Andrea Thomas, Senior Vice President of Sustainability at Walmart, said the initiative will have multiple impacts.
We are broadening and accelerating our efforts as we grow our food business to make sure that we do it in a more sustainable way. We want to help small and medium-sized farmers to lead a better life. And we want to make sure as we grow the agriculture, or our farmers grow the agriculture, that they do so in a way that really protects the earth and the sensitive ecosystems. And ultimately, we want to deliver to our customers the highest quality food that we can at a very affordable price.
Walmart President Mike Duke divided the initiative into three broad areas. First, by 2015, Walmart will sell $1 billion in food grown by 1 million small and medium farmers. Second, Walmart will ask suppliers to measure their water, energy, fertilizer, and pesticides they use per unit of food produced, and to reduce food waste. And third, Walmart will work to reduce deforestation of the world's rainforests and decrease greenhouse gas emissions by cutting two major contributors, palm oil and beef production. And its global strategies require stores in India to source 50% of fresh produce through its direct farm program, in China to increase its organic certified lines, in Japan to reduce in-store produce waste by 35%, and in Canada to purchase 30% of its produce locally. And stateside, consumers will see lots of produce labeled grown in the USA. Again, Andrea Thomas, Senior Vice President of Sustainability at Walmart.
In the US, we plan to support our farmers and their communities by doubling the amount of produce that we source locally and reaching up to 9% of sales. So for example, in the Midwest, we'll source more potatoes and apples, more sweet corn and blueberries out of the Southeast, and out of the Delta region, more strawberries and more cabbages.
Walmart's so-called Heritage Agriculture Program. In developing this initiative, Walmart said it consulted with suppliers, universities, and non-government groups, including the World Wildlife Fund, Conservation International, Rainforest Alliance, the Nature Conservancy, the Field to Market Alliance, and Environmental Defense Fund.
I think this announcement is an important outcome of many years of work on healthy food, sustainable agriculture, sustainable energy, and interest by consumers who want to know where their food is grown, how it's grown.
Leif Kinberg is a farm energy specialist with the National Center for Appropriate Technology, which operates an office in Fayetteville.
Agricultural production is probably about 3% of total energy consumption just in the U.S. The food system makes up somewhere around 14 or a bit more in terms of percentage of the total energy used in the U.S. Processing, packaging, transportation, wholesale, are all big parts of that 14%. And obviously, Walmart's involvement and commitment to the Sustainability Index and sustainable agriculture will be a key part of that.
Kinberg is referring to Walmart's formation of a sustainability consortium 2 years ago to establish global scientific standards to measure the sustainability of consumer products. But he said that Walmart's goal to expand small and medium farm business income should also factor in profit.
the discussion that they're going to have and some of the challenges that they're going to encounter are not only going to focus on income, but are also really going to focus on profit margins and what the farmer actually gets in terms of a fair price for that food. And that those will be key considerations in the program.
Kinberg also pointed out that in certain areas, it may be more sustainable to truck produce from a distance rather than purchase locally.
Again, it's a complex question between local and sustainable, and one doesn't necessarily suggest the other. A local product raised in a greenhouse is going to have very different environmental implications when you think about the energy intensity in producing that product.
Leif Kinberg's advised small farmers growing for Walmart and said it can be challenging supplying the retail giant.
The producers that I have worked with in the past often pool their resources, small farmers pooling, entering co-ops or small agreements between several producers, working with Extension and others who can broker some of the purchasing. There's a lot of other considerations when a small farmer starts to work with a large buyer such as Walmart. And they're going to have to work through those. Hopefully, Walmart will be very proactive in establishing a sourcing system that facilitates small farmers to work one-on-one with the buyer in an efficient and fair way.
And with Walmart operating more than 8,400 retail units in 15 countries, Leif Kinberg says the sustainable food message will easily reach millions of people.
I think this is a great way to spread the sustainability message. It's a clear message to producers that sustainable agriculture, meaning social, environmental, and economic responsibility, is something that the market is ready for, that retailers are ready for. I think producers are going to note that and start to consider what the options are for them. Other large retailers are also going to clearly hear this message. And are going to start to identify their own niches for sustainable produce and organic products. It's going to send a clear market signal, I think, to investors that will start to pay attention to sustainable agriculture on a level they have perhaps not in the past. It's clear that sustainably produced food is for consumers at every level of the social and economic scale.
And as one of the world's largest food supply chains, Walmart says it's committed to reducing and optimizing the resources required to run it. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The 2010 midterm elections are 2 weeks from today. Three of Arkansas's four seats in the U.S. House of Representatives are open. Third District Congressman John Bozeman is challenging incumbent Democrat Blanche Lincoln for her Senate seat. And Second District Democrat Vic Snyder and First District Democrat Marion Barry are not seeking re-election. Only Democrat Mike Ross is seeking a return to the U.S. House from Arkansas. TalkBusiness.net and Hendricks College have conducted a late-season survey of the state's congressional districts, and Roby Brock, the owner and publisher of TalkBusiness.net, gives us the numbers.
In the 4th Congressional District, Democratic Congressman Mike Ross still enjoys a comfortable lead over his Republican rival, Beth Ann Rankin, 52-34%. Green Party nominee Joshua Drake polled 3%, and undecided voters stood at 11%. Now, this poll has a margin of error of about 4.3%. When we last polled this race in late August, Ross held a 49-31% advantage over Rankin. In the 3rd District, Republican Steve Womack holds a huge advantage over his Democratic challenger, David Whitaker. Likely district voters are supporting Womack by a 59-21% margin. With no other candidates in the race, 20% of district voters remain undecided. Now, from our last poll in August, Womack's lead has grown from the previous 55-31% margin. In the heated 2nd District race, Republican Tim Griffin stands right at 50% of the vote, compared to Democrat Joyce Elliott's 38%. Independent Lance Levy earned 3%. Green Party nominee Lewis Kennedy stood at 2.5%. The rest, 6%, were undecided. Now, 2 months ago, when we polled this race, Griffin led Elliott 52-35%. So there's been a little bit of tightening in this race, although Griffin's 12-point lead remains pretty comfortable. Now, watch for this race to grow a little tighter in the last 2 weeks. Finally, the first district race. 2 months ago in mid-August, Republican Rick Crawford led Democrat Chad Causey by 16 points, 48-32%. It was a poll we conducted twice to test the accuracy of our results. In our latest poll, Rick Crawford now has 42% support to Chad Causey's 34%, an 8-point race. Green Party nominee Ken Adler polled 4%, and 20% still remain undecided. And with those undecided voters being so high, this race still has a lot of room for movement in the waning weeks.
Roby Brock is the publisher of the magazine Talk Business Quarterly and the website talkbusiness.net. Support for Roby Brock's coverage of Arkansas business and politics is provided by Hendricks College, a residential undergraduate liberal arts college. Learn more at hendricks.edu/odyssey. And the Little Rock National Airport at fly-lit.com, where travelers can book air, car, and hotel reservations online, track flights, and check the weather. Mobile phone access is also available at fly-lit.com/mobile. And Bank of the Ozarks, offering the tools and services to make Arkansas businesses work. More information is available at bankozarks.com. And there is more about midterm elections on this edition of Ozarks at Large. How often does the party not in the White House gain ground in Congress during midterm elections? Our history doctor, Bill Smith, will look back at the contract with America, the swing around the circle, and other midterm election lessons. That's still ahead on today's Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. The 2010 midterm elections are approaching, the first Tuesday in November. Many eyes across the country are watching to see what this means for the Republican Party, the Democratic Party, the Tea Party, President Obama's administration, and our history doctor, Bill Smith, is here to give us a dose of some reality about midterm elections. Welcome back, Bill.
Glad to be back.
Okay, midterm elections. Big deal?
They are a very big deal, and especially to the political party of the sitting president. In the 20th century, every president has had a loss for his party in the midterms. Now, four of them have served long enough to have a second midterm in which they were able to turn that around, but the consensus is the president's party is going to lose. The only question is, how much?
In my lifetime, it's happened quite a bit. Reagan in his first midterm, Clinton in his. Is this something that has happened, something new in the 20th century, or does this date back to, you know, our first presidents?
Well, we've seen a lot of the coverage in the media talking about 1994 and Bill Clinton facing the Republicans' contract with America. And here we go again with our very presentist view. No, as a matter of fact, the idea of banding together what is essentially local politics, the House of Representative races, in the midterm elections into national campaigns, either on the behalf of the sitting president or some party out of power or some issue, is not recent at all. Certainly the Tea Party is getting a lot of media attention, both pro and con, and the echo event in 94, but you can go back to some American midterms and find these issues and events all the way through our history. Sure, contract with America is getting the examination from the media, but what about the swing around the circle?
Okay. I'll admit, I don't know what swing around the circle is.
Well, Kyle, set the Wayback Machine for 1866, and President Andrew Johnson, who had come into office after Abraham Lincoln's assassination. He became the first president to have his veto overridden by Congress, as Johnson, the fusion Democrat from the Civil War period, is running up against a very Republican Congress. Johnson is not pleased with this, and he will go out and campaign to try to cut down the Republican majorities and associate himself with Democrats, some of them who had questionable racial elements to their campaigns and the country side that they were coming from. He saw, though, that he was in a bad situation with the GOP, and he had to do something about it. So the president set off on a tour of the country. This was unprecedented. It was called the Swing Around the Circle, trying to support Democratic candidates. It horribly backfired on Johnson and set the stage for a showdown with the radical Republicans in Congress that eventually will lead to Johnson getting another first, the first president to be impeached by Congress. He allowed the GOP to go from a solid majority to a veto-proof majority, losing 37 seats with his tour of speeches, many of which ended with violence, the president being booed off the stage, or in one town, the president not able to give the speech at all because of the protests against his appearance.
That's a PR nightmare.
Yes, indeed it was.
So then this gain by the party that's not in the White House in the middle, is this just kind of the ebb and flow, what we should expect?
For the most part, yes. From the founding fathers to Barack Obama, midterms have served as sort of regularly scheduled parliamentary referendums on how the sitting president and his party are seen by the people in doing their jobs.
So is there a connection then between, can you go back and see presidents that were more popular at the midterm do a better job of hanging on to seats in both chambers?
Well, I do think you can see a pretty direct correlation between the president's popularity and the amount of midterm success the opposition can have. When Bill Clinton took a 54-seat hit in his first term, it was based on a lot of negativity in the country toward his program. Now, he turned that around and scored one of the rare midterm gains in 1998. So within one presidency, you see the two halves of that equation. The same can be said for George Bush. In 2002, seen as an effective leader coming out of 9/11, he gets a mild 8-seat increase in the House. But by the time circumstances around the world turned against Bush and perception of his ability to lead and his party waned, this fueled a 31-seat loss at his other midterm election in 2006. And not only a 31-seat loss, it put the Democrats back in control of the House for the first time since Gingrich's achievement against Clinton in 94. You know, the other really clear indicator of this is Harry Truman. He hit an approval rating low of 32% in 1946, and his 54-seat loss was clearly over his handling of the immediate post-war economic traumas the country was facing, and a natural desire of the country to just dump out the sitting party in a post-war circumstance. So, you know, there's your two record turnouts, 54 seats in the modern political era.
The most memorable one in recent history is 1994. Newt Gingrich led a Republican revolution in the House in the middle of Bill Clinton's first term.
That's right. Gingrich was the Republican minority leader, and he came up with the idea of the Contract with America, a series of votes and referendums that all of the individuals running for office signed on to this pledge that these items would be brought up in the House. And it did make one of the two most significant House turnarounds in modern U.S. history. So that 54-seat swing in 46 for Truman and the 54-seat swing for Clinton does kind of give you this idea that, hey, well, maybe it's a Democrat issue. It stands out, though, because the GOP took control of the House for the first time since 1954, a House that Republican Dwight Eisenhower had lost, and now Newt Gingrich is able to bring back.
Those 54 seats that you mentioned, those two times 54 seats changed hands in the House, that the record?
Oh, no.
No?
We talk about the 54 really in the post-Second World War period, you know, in our modern political times. But, oh, not even close. Not even for the 20th century. Franklin Delano Roosevelt dropped 81 seats to the GOP in 1938.
81.
And again, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a president that we see as eminently popular, yet he and his party in power in 38 were facing a recession that was within the Great Depression. His failed attempt at packing the Supreme Court also blew back on him. So he turned a record majority of 338 to 88, dropping 81 seats. Still a very significant majority, but you know, you've made a considerable impact. FDR's mark of 81 just edges Republican Warren G. Harding, who dropped an incredible 77 seats to the Democrats in 1922. Losing 50 or more seats is a pretty common number for the sitting president at the start of the century, with Wilson and Taft in their midterms. Here's the interesting stat, and this is where I think we go back to the media hullabaloo about Barack Obama might lose the House and 37 seats turn over. Every sitting president in the 20th century has taken some amount of loss during midterms in their careers. Only three times in the 20th century has the sitting president and his party avoided a midterm loss. The exceptions were Theodore Roosevelt, who gained 7 in 1902, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who gained 9 in 1934, and Clinton, who gained 5 in 98. Now, each one of those presidents also had, as we've talked about, very significant losses. The only president that came close to escaping not having a midterm loss in their career was JFK. He lost 4 seats in 1962.
In his only midterm.
In his only midterm, but, you know, think about that. He's coming out of the Cuban Missile Crisis. The country is you know, we're having the Camelot popularity, but even JFK lost seats against his popularity.
I have a feeling you've told us about the 81 that FDR dropped in 38. You've told us about 77 that was dropped. I have a feeling we still haven't heard the biggest turnaround in a midterm election yet.
1894, Grover Cleveland is facing the worst economic period in U.S. history to date, second only to the Great Depression. The panic of 1893 set off unemployment, strikes, violence, nationwide rail strikes, and it shattered the Democratic Party. The GOP won 130 seats, the greatest midterm swing in U.S. history. The loss opened the door for the populist elements to take over the Democratic Party and bring about the great silver and gold debate that dominated the 1896 presidential election. Well, right before that, 1890, the Democrats made their big shot on the Republicans. The Congress in 1888 had begun to spend incredibly, so that by the 1890 midterm cycle, you had another one of these theme efforts by the party out of power, as the Democrats labeled the Republicans as the billion-dollar Congress, which indeed they were, the first Congress to have a billion-dollar federal budget. The label worked, and calling out the spendthrift Republicans led to an 86-seat gain for the Democrats and a 93-seat loss for the GOP. The balance went to the new populist party, which was coming about at that time. Ulysses S. Grant also lost 96 seats during his second term in 1874 as the Democrats were trying to regain some control and capitalize on scandals that had plagued the former Union general, now not so great, U.S. president.
Well, polls suggest that this sitting president is going to take a hit in just a few weeks. Any reason to think that history would show us differently?
Well, I'm not one to say that history will exactly repeat itself. I'm not a big fan of that old cliche. However, circumstances are certainly in place for a significant change. After all, even Abraham Lincoln took a midterm hit. The Democrats picked up 28 seats in his 1862 midterm during the opening years of the Civil War, and he would have lost control of the House except for the burgeoning new GOP's alliance with the Unionist Party's representatives.
So, keep your eyes on the results from across the country, and until there is another issue to be taken to task,
we're history.
Bill Smith has his PhD in history, and he teaches history at Northwest Arkansas Community College. There's more about midterm elections at OzarksAtLarge.com. Just look for the link later this afternoon at our webpage, OzarksAtLarge.com.
Hi, this is KUAF Station Manager Rick Stockdale. Our fall on-air fundraiser begins Wednesday at 6 a.m., and we're hoping to end it on Friday. Our goal is to raise $140,000, and we're counting every dollar donated to KUAF during October toward that goal. You can go online now at KUAF.com and click on Contribute Now, or just mail a check to KUAF, University of Arkansas, Fayetteville, 72701. Your contribution today can help make this fall's on-air fundraiser our shortest ever. Thanks a lot.
This is Ozarks at Large. Musical theater has taken us to many places. Valley High, disputed turf of the Sharks and Jets, and the cellars below the Paris Opera House. Beginning this week, the University of Arkansas Theater takes us to another place.
Well, hello there, and welcome to Urinetown. Not the place, of course, the musical. Urinetown, the place, is, well, it's a place you'll hear people refer to a lot throughout the show.
You hear the news?
Urinetown, the musical, is actually several things. Part metaphor, part dystopian fantasy, a broad comedy, and, at times, a very traditional musical love story.
It's kind of a mythical place, you understand? A bad place. A place you won't see until Act Two. And then... well, let's just say it's filled with symbolism and things like that.
First things first, let's talk about that title. It's unconventional, it's a pun, and it's potentially bothersome. Kate Frank, the director for the University of Arkansas Theater production of Urinetown, the musical, says when she first heard the title, she might have winced a bit.
And I have to say the look on my mother's face was the same way. I'm directing Urinetown. And once you see the show, you realize that it is absolutely the right title for the show. And it's a title that is a joke itself on titles. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This show is a parody of musical theater, and it parodies almost everything about every bit of writing that goes into a musical, including the naming of the show.
Urinetown the musical is a satire, and it has a big enough lens to take aim at all sorts of targets. Capitalism, corporate mismanagement, and politics included. But some of the sharpest stings are reserved for the conventions of musical theater. Song titles include Too Much Exposition and Act One Finale. But Mark Hallman and Greg Kotas, the creators of the Tony-winning play, also address serious topics of conservation and social responsibility. Reportedly inspired by a visit to a pay toilet in Europe, the script concentrates on a mega corporation's ability to control water and thus that corporation's elimination of free toilets. People refusing to use the pay-as-you-go facilities are sent to a sort of Siberia called Urinetown. Still, there's room for a song like Follow Your Heart between star-crossed lovers Hope Cladwell and Bobby Strong.
Someday I'll need someone whose heart joins with mine. Aortas and arteries all intertwined. They'll beat so much stronger than they could apart. Eight chambers of muscle to hustle the love in our heart. Love is kind and considerate.
Jacqueline Jones, who plays Hope Cladwell, the daughter of the evil mega corporation's boss, says the play manages a balance between earnest and farcical, often at the exact same time.
There are moments throughout the show where there are sincere emotions, and you do see a sincere story unfold in front of you on stage, with those satirical moments tied in. But it is a very soft moment between Bobby and Hope where you do see this traditional love story sort of be played out in front of you, obviously with some jokes mixed in. Our, you know, everything is a pun in the show, down to our names, you know, Hope Cladwell and Bobby Strong, so...
Even the title is a pun.
Yes, so. Everything is a pun.
The show has required plenty of work. Jeannie Lee is the musical director, Gail Liftwich the choreographer, and there is a singing, dancing cast of nearly two dozen. The multi-storied set puts action on more than just ground level. William Sylvie plays Officer Lockstock in the cast, but he also helped build the set.
The upper balcony is 14 feet off of the stage. It is at the same height as the balcony rail we put the lights on behind the audience.
I've never actually experienced a set that was this high.
Again, Jacqueline Jones from the cast of Urinetown, the musical.
I mean, I've had different levels where you're on a balcony for a balcony scene, or you're upstairs in a house, but this is... trying to simulate the top of buildings in a real city, and it's very high up. And the first time we actually got to go on the set and kind of climb around, we were just amazed. We were all really excited to go up to the highest level and look down. And
nervous.
And very nervous, yes.
The tiered stage allows the production to show a distinction between rich and poor, a major theme of the script. Cast members negotiate the levels, but they also have plenty of flying exits and entrances with rapid costume changes in between. The show ran on Broadway for nearly 1,000 performances for 3 years after an off-Broadway debut. That Broadway run earned 3 Tony Awards, including the award for Best Original Score and Best Book for a Musical. The University of Arkansas run of Urinetown, the Musical, opens Friday night at 8 and continues with nighttime performances Saturday night and October 27th through the 30th. Sunday matinees are this weekend and next. Each begins at 2. And University of Arkansas students pay no admission charge for Wednesday, Thursday, and Sunday performances.
Come see it. It's a great show.
Or we'll send you to Urinetown.
Bring enough money for the bathroom.
That was a joke.
This is Urinetown.
It's Tuesday, October 19th, 2010. I'm Kyle Kellums. This is Ozarks at Large. And with me, as she is almost every day, Becca Bacon-Martin, the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
Kyle, what's your favorite holiday?
Okay, you're going to get... people are going to yell at me. My favorite holiday is Memorial Day.
Really?
Here's why.
Okay.
No one likes my answer. Not my wife.
I like your answer.
Memorial Day, it's the beginning of summer, and I love summer. Mm-hmm. I love everything that goes with summer. There's little drama involved with Memorial Day.
No fireworks, no...
No fireworks, no expectations. Maybe your friends have a barbecue, something like that. Third, I just like the idea of thinking about people who were special to you or sacrificed, and you can do it in your own private way. I love Memorial Day. It's a 3-day weekend. Not that I don't like other holidays, but I love Memorial Day and I love Labor Day.
I think that's a great answer.
Well, thank you.
I ask because I love Halloween.
Well, I like Halloween too.
Because when I, in my vision of myself, I am Abby Sciuto from NCIS. That's how I look to me.
Okay.
I love Halloween. And tonight, there is a ghost walk titled Grieving Widows and Denizens, coordinated by the Peel Compton Foundation in Bentonville. A trio of, one assumes, grieving widows in black will lead guests on a tour of the Bentonville Cemetery at 6 o'clock tonight, 6 o'clock Thursday, and again on October 26th and 28th. The tour will return to the Peel Mansion, where a public hanging will be recreated.
Good grief. Wow.
Tickets are $25 for adults and $20 for children 6 to 12. I'm not sure I'd take a 6-year-old.
I was about to say, I think you want to think about that.
Yeah, not sure about that. And you can find out more, and I suggest you would want to check on tickets in advance, at 254-3870. Also tonight, The Color Purple opens at the Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. 7 o'clock shows tonight, tomorrow, and Thursday, so don't forget that early curtain time. It is, of course, based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Alice Walker and the Oscar-winning film by Steven Spielberg, but it's a musical. So they've taken the very serious mm-hmm. stories of Seeley's life and added gospel and soul and R&B.
And music that is appropriate to the time period as the play moves on.
Should be really amazing. Has gotten great reviews nationwide. Continues through Sunday evening, and tickets start at $39. And tonight at the Alma Performing Arts Center, the U.S. Marine Band.
They'll fill the place with sound.
Oh, yeah. 7:30. It's free, but tickets are required. So you
call.
Need to call 632-2129 and see if you can still squeeze in.
Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
Singer Jennifer Holliday was born on this date in 1960 in Houston, Texas. Holliday went straight from the Pleasant Grove Baptist Church Choir to Broadway. She was discovered singing in the choir by a dancer, Jamie Patterson, who was performing in Houston in the musical A Chorus Line. Holiday made her Broadway debut in the musical Your Arms Too Short to Box with God. While performing on Broadway, Holiday captured the attention of director-choreographer Michael Bennett. Bennett cast Holiday in the starring role of Effie Melody White in his production of Dreamgirls, which garnered the singer a Tony Award for Best Actress in a Musical. Her other Broadway musical credits include Chicago, Grease, Downhearted Blues, The Story of Bessie Smith, and Harlem Suite. Holiday has recorded several chart-topping singles. Her signature song, And I Am Telling You I'm Not Going, reached number one on the R&B charts. Holiday won a Grammy Award for Best R&B Female Vocal Performance for the song, and was awarded a second Grammy for Best Inspirational Vocal Performance for her rendition of Duke Ellington's Come Sunday. Holiday received an honorary doctorate of music from the Berklee College of Music in Boston, Massachusetts. She is also an advocate of mental health issues and speaks often for depression awareness and erasing the stigma of depression, as well as suicide prevention for youth. On this date in 1898, William F. Kirby from Texarkana, who had recently graduated with a bachelor's degree in law from Cumberland University in Lebanon, Tennessee, in the same class as his father, married Ella Kelly of Texarkana. Kirby established a law practice and later became an associate justice of the Arkansas Supreme Court. He also served as state attorney general and U.S. senator. In 1903, he was commissioned by the General Assembly to produce an authoritative compilation of Arkansas statutes, which was published the following year as Kirby's Digest of the Statutes of Arkansas. Also on this date in 1987, the stock market crashed as the Dow Jones Industrial Average plunged 508 points, or 22.6% in value, its second biggest percentage drop. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
This is Ozarks at Large. Thursday night, four acclaimed songwriters will sit down and play their music and discuss how their songs were created. The latest edition of Songs in the Ville, hosted by Fayetteville's own Efron White, is Thursday night at the York Ballroom on Dixon Street in Fayetteville. This month's edition will feature three Nashville-area songwriters, multiple Grammy winner Carl Jackson, Grammy nominee Lori Cordell, and award-winning songwriter Jerry Salley. Combined, the three out-of-towners have had songs recorded by Glenn Campbell, Trisha Yearwood, Reba McEntire, Garth Brooks, George Strait, Dolly Parton, Dwight Yoakam, and scores of others. Yesterday, we invited Efron White to our studio and reached Jerry Salley on the phone in Nashville to talk a little bit about what we can expect Thursday night at the York Ballroom and a little bit about the job of songwriting.
It's just like a day at work for me. I mean, every day I'm either writing or in the studio demoing songs or out pitching songs, you know, one of the three. And I kind of subscribe to the Bob McDill way of songwriting. Bob McDill was one of the great songwriters here in Nashville and was a huge hit songwriter in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. But I remember reading when I was growing up in Ohio about Bob McDill and his songwriting, how he approached it. And he said, I treat it just like a job. I show up every morning at 9 o'clock. I leave every day at 5. Some days I don't write anything, but if I've written one great line that day, I've had a good day. And so that's kind of stuck with me ever since I read that interview. And I treat my job. Now, the inspiration doesn't always come. You know, some days are, you know, the old saying, some days are diamonds, some days are stone, you know. But I subscribe to that. If I come up with one great line a day, I've had a good day.
Do you think, here I go asking the question.
That's fine. That's fine.
But that's what I kind of do at our shows. You know, I try to ask questions of all my guest writers to see how they approach their songwriting and everything. But I was going to ask if you find it really helps you to be ready when the right moment comes, by going and doing that every single day.
Absolutely. I think so. I mean, one of the hardest parts to me of being a songwriter is I can't turn this off. You know, my dad worked at a paper mill growing up, and when he came home at 5:30, 6 o'clock, that paper mill was behind him. You know, it was just, he never thought about it again until he had to get up and go the next day. Songwriting is something you can never turn it off. I mean, I can be driving down the road, see a billboard, I got to write that down. You know, if it's got a hook or it's got some inspiration or something, I hear a conversation, I'm constantly listening to other people talk, trying to pick up tidbits of information or something I might be able to write about. It just kind of, that's the only thing, sometimes you think you're going crazy because you can't turn it off. That's the bad part. But you're right, Efren. If you discipline yourself, is what I call it, you know, discipline yourself to write every day and to, you know,
yeah,
to make
I
this
could,
your
I could use a little
vocation.
More of that discipline myself.
Well, but I do think, you know, I do a lot of co-writing, too, and one of my co-writers told me one time, he said, well, if I'm not smart enough to think of it, that he said, if you're having one of those days where you're not thinking of much but your co-writer's, you know, coming up with a lot of the good ideas, he said, if you're not smart enough to come up with it that day, you better be smart enough to recognize it when your co-writer says the right line.
Well, let me ask about when you have a singer-songwriter in the round situation. There will be four of you Thursday night.
Yeah. Right.
It'll also be Carl Jackson and Larry Cordell. When the four of you are there and you're kind of swapping stories and you're playing for each other, can you pick something up then? Can you be inspired during that situation?
Oh, absolutely. Don't you think, Efren? I believe
so. Oh, yeah.
So.
Sure can.
It always inspires me to hear great singers and songwriters do their stuff anyway. But absolutely.
Efren, let's... listeners who might not be familiar with the Songs in the Ville situation, how's that set up? When they walk in to the UARC there on Dixon Street, what will they see? Where will they be? How will that work?
Well, they will, when they first walk in, they're going to see some chairs set up in the center of the room with a single lamp lighting this little circular area. And myself and our guest artists are going to sit in that circle facing each other. And I've got the tables in that room pulled up real nice, close and tight around that circle. So they'll feel, the audience sits there and they'll feel like they're right there with us in a living room or something.
Right, that's exactly right.
And it's just a great way to experience real songwriting, you know, because you hone in on the songs themselves, and we discuss the songs as we go and everything, so that the audience feels like a real part.
Do you, as songwriters, I open this up to both of you, when you might hear a colleague, a friend, a fellow songwriter with a great turn of phrase, do you ever have a little bit, I don't know, a twang of insecurity that says, oh man, I'm never going to get one that good? And not jealousy, but just, wow. Where did he or she get that?
What I normally do is say, damn, I wish I would have thought of that.
Yeah. I do that a lot.
I don't get jealous. I just get mad at myself for not thinking of it.
can songwriting be something you try too hard to do?
Oh, yeah.
I think so, too.
I try too hard. I've been trying too hard lately.
Really?
Well, I think you can stretch yourself out, don't you, Efren?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's... I think that might be one of the biggest things that comes into what they call writer's block.
I agree.
Trying too hard.
Jerry, thank you so much for your time. We look forward to you Thursday night.
Well, thank you so much. And just to let everybody know, too, you know, Carl is a two-time Grammy Award winner, and Larry Cordell wrote Highway 40 Blues and Mama Don't Forget to Pray for Me. They're just both incredible talents. So Carl is a world-class banjo and guitar player. And and of course, Efren is so talented, and Fayetteville's very fortunate to have him there supporting local songwriters, and we appreciate him having us. We sure do. We're looking forward to it.
Jerry, thank you very much. Efren, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
The next Songs in the Ville is Thursday night at the York Ballroom on Dixon Street in Fayetteville, beginning at 7:30. We talked with Efron White of Fayetteville. He's the host of the Songs in the Ville series. We also talked with Jerry Sally, one of the three Nashville-area songwriters who will join Efron Thursday night, along with Carl Jackson and Larry Cordell. Before we let Jerry Sally go, we asked him about one of his songs, titled Like John in the Jordan, a song he recorded with the Oak Ridge Boys on his CD, New Songs, Old Friends.
I wrote that song, I co-wrote that with a fellow by the name of Rusty Golden, and Rusty's one of my best friends in life, lives up in Hendersonville near me, and Rusty's daddy is William Lee Golden of the Oak Ridge Boys, the long-haired Oak Ridge Boy. And when we got together, I actually heard, I go to church there in Hendersonville, and the preacher was talking one day, and he actually used the phrase, just like John in the Jordan, you know? And, boy, I thought that's a great title. So I took the title over to Rusty's house, and he said, man, he said, I don't know if this would make a good story or not, but he said, my mother, this is true, his mother was scared. She didn't know how to swim. She never did learn how to swim and was petrified of water. I mean, she was scared of drowning. And when she went to get baptized, it was just, it took every ounce of faith she had to go under, because she was just had a phobia about it. And so that's really where that came from. Now, the first line of the song is Brother Poole was standing with his hands up in the air. Brother Charles Poole was actually one of my preachers in Nashville when I first moved to Nashville and joined the United Methodist Church here. So some of the character names are real people. And the story in the second verse about Mama getting baptized is a true story.
Daddy held my mother's hand. She was next in line.
She never learned to swim and was afraid.
But she faced her fear of water,
took a breath and closed her eyes.
They went under for the Lord to show her faith.
Just like John in the Jordan.
Jerry Sally will be one of four songwriters at Thursday night's Song in the Ville at the York Ballroom in Fayetteville. Local support for Ozarks at Large comes from a special HD Cinecast performance of A Prairie Home Companion Thursday at the Razorback Cinema in Fayetteville and the Malco Fort Smith Cinema. Special guests include Old Crow Medicine Show, Joe Ely, and Sarah Watkins. Tickets and more information available at KUAF.com or PrairieHome.org. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Harrison, a listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. KUAF has proudly served as your source for NPR programming for the past 25 years. Remember, you can listen for free online at KUAF.com. And our on-air fundraiser begins tomorrow. We're trying to raise as much money as possible before tomorrow morning in hopes of ending this fundraiser by Friday. That would make it the shortest fundraiser in KUAF history. You can do your part right now by contributing online at KUAF.com. You can also mail us a check to KUAF, University of Arkansas, Fayetteville, Arkansas, 72701. I'm Kyle Kellums. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget, you can hear brand new daily editions of Ozarks at Large every day, or at least every Monday through Friday at 9, repeated then that evening, and you can hear weekend Ozarks at Large each Sunday morning at 9 o'clock.